Welcome to the podcast of Paley Presbyterian Church. The following sermon is by our associate pastor, Becca Bruner.
Throughout the last century, we've had among us a great prophet who has spoken quite wisely into our culture. He's written several books over the years, important books, impactful books that have changed the way we think about ourselves, the ways we think about each other, the way we think about our world. By the time he died in 1991, his books had sold over 600 million copies and had been translated into 20 languages. His name, familiar one, Theodore Seuss Geisel, otherwise known to many of us as Dr. Seuss. And one of the very, very important, insightful books Dr. Seuss wrote was this one, The Sneetches. Now, so for a moment, I'd like to invite you to go back in time, be a kid again, just for a minute here, and allow me to read to you from the first couple of pages. Now, the star belly sneetches had bellies with stars. The plain belly sneetches had none upon thars. Those stars weren't so big, they were really so small, you might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star belly sneetches would brag, "We're the best kind of sneetch on the beaches." With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort, "We'll have nothing to do with the plain belly sort." And whenever they met some, when they were out walking, they'd hike right on past without even talking. When the star belly children went out to play ball, could a plain belly get in the game? Not at all. You could only play if your bellies had stars. And the plain belly children, they had none upon thars. We'll leave it there. If you want to borrow it later, see how it turns out, let me know. You have to get in line behind Eleanor. She's promised it next. But the story goes on. But you get the point from the first couple pages. Dr. Seuss, he's lifting up this reality, and of course, a lighthearted way as he does, but this reality that we as human beings have this tendency within us to differentiate ourselves from one another. We separate ourselves from one another. We create these categories for one another: Republican, Democrat, Christian, Muslim, Presbyterian, Catholic, man, woman, white, black. The list could go on and on and on. We create these divisions within ourselves, which is bad enough, but we don't stop there. You see, then we place value on these differences. Like the sneetches, we start to think and act and behave in ways that because we are in one category and not the other, well, then there's something better about us. We're somehow better, we're somehow smarter, we're somehow more attractive or more worthy, whatever the value may be. We do this in these categories, and everyone does this. All human beings do this, but I have to say we're especially guilty of this in the church. We Christians are remarkably good at setting up these intricate systems of who's good and who's bad. Who's in and who's out? Whose bellies, some bigger than others, whose bellies have stars and whose have none upon thars? But Jesus sees things differently. Jesus sees us differently. Jesus sees us all the same. We are all the same for all of us, for every person in this room, for every person in this world, for every person who has ever lived. Jesus has two words for all of us: sinner and saint, fallen and forgiven, lost and found, holy and completely messed up, holy and completely loved. Pastor and author Tim Keller puts it this way. He writes, "We, all of us, we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared to believe. Yet at the same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared to hope." See, we want to split these things apart. You know, there's good people, the saints, that's us. And then there's the bad people, the sinners, that's them. But that's not how Jesus sees it. What we try to split apart, Jesus holds together. Jesus holds together these disparate things we think that are so disparate, namely grace and truth. Grace and truth. The gospel writer John puts it this way in the introduction to his gospel, his eyewitness account of the life of Jesus. John writes about Jesus and he calls him the Word. The Word. Jesus is the Word. He's the ultimate self-communication from God. That's Jesus. And the Word didn't just say a word. No, John writes, he says, the Word became flesh and lived among us. Jesus, the ultimate self-communication of the God of the universe, came, and he came and became one of us. He put on human skin and bones and lived here with us. We saw him, John says. We saw him. We talked with him. We hung out with him. We saw God in the flesh in action, and here's what we saw. It said, the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory. The glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Grace and truth. We tend to think of them as opposites. We split them apart. You know, we know the definitions of these words. We say truth. Well, truth says you're accountable. And grace says, well, you're forgiven. Grace says, oh, you're fine. Where truth says, no, you're broken. Grace says, no matter what, I will love you. And truth says, yeah, well, there are consequences. And depending on your personality, we tend to lean in one direction towards one or the other. Most parents, I would say, as kids, we knew this, we internalized. Most parents, they tend to be one or the other. You know, I got challenged on this at 7:30, because in my family, dad was truth. And mom was grace. Now, somebody at 7:30, she said, uh-oh, I was all about truth. But in my family, mom was grace. And so what do you do when you want to get your way? You go to mom, and you bat your eyelashes, and you put on your sweetest face and your sweetest voice, and you say, Mom, can I please? And on a good day, mom says, yes. But on a bad day, what does mom say? She says, well, go ask your dad. And that's really bad, because you know what dad's going to say. Dad's going to say no, because dad is truth. When it comes to grace and truth, we tend to lean in one direction or the other. But if I'm really honest, I kind of want both. But here's how I want it. When it comes to me, and when it comes to how I live my life, I want grace. But when it comes to other people and how they live their lives, well, I want truth. But here's what John says about Jesus that's so amazing. He wasn't one or the other the way we are. John said, I spent time with Jesus. I spent 3 years with Jesus. I saw him teach. I saw him interact with people. I saw everything about him. And Jesus was absolutely filled to the brim with both grace and truth. John tells so many stories about this. If you read through the Gospel of John, you see it everywhere. Jesus would encounter somebody, and you'd think he's going to go one way or the other. Maybe he's going to lay down the law this time. He's going to lay down the law with truth. Or, you know, maybe he'll be kind and gentle and tender with grace. And the people around Jesus, that's what they expected. They expected he's either going to zig, he's going to zag, grace or truth. And Jesus, every time, surprises everyone going straight down the middle. So we're going to look at just one of the times that happened. It's recorded in the Gospel of John, chapter 8, and we're going to start at verse 2. John writes, early in the morning, he, being Jesus, came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Now the star-belly sneetches had bellies with stars, and the plain-bellied sneetches had none upon theirs. The stars weren't so big. They were really quite small. You'd think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. It's kind of always been this way, but especially amongst religious folk. People of God, we try to separate it out. Good people, bad people, saints, sinners, and Jesus, he's having none of it. Which made the good people, the religious leaders, the saints of society, this made them all kinds of mad. Because as far as they were concerned, they had earned their fair share of grace, thank you very much. And everyone else, well, it was time for them to get their dose of truth. So these religious leaders, they did this crazy thing. They set Jesus up. When Jesus came to the temple to teach, as was his custom, they were ready. And as soon as he sat down, they dragged this woman in, this poor woman whom they had caught in the very act of adultery. It's a little awkward if you think about it. I mean, John doesn't tell us how they did it, but we're left to infer that in order to set this trap for Jesus, they had to set a trap for her too. These men, these religious leaders, they'd found a way to get this woman into an adulterous relationship, and they'd waited. They'd waited, like outside her window, outside her door. They were there, ready for that moment, to catch her in the very act of adultery, just so they could seize the opportunity, witness the transgression, and drag her in all her guilty shame to stand before Jesus. All so that they could force Jesus' hand. Make him zig or zag, choose grace or truth. And they knew, no matter what Jesus chose, he would lose. See, they come to Jesus quoting the Old Testament law. They say, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law of Moses, we're commanded to stone such women. What do you say?" Here's a problem. If Jesus zigs towards grace, he's going against the law of Moses, and that's bad. See, if Jesus does that, the religious leaders can say, "Ugh, he doesn't believe Moses. He is a false prophet." But on the other hand, if Jesus zags towards the truth and okays stoning this woman, well, that's bad too. Then the many, many who have come to follow him, to trust Jesus as the friend of sinners, well, they think, you know, all this has just been a lie. And they walk away. So religious leaders, they're sure they can't lose on this one. Moses commanded us to stone such women. What do you say? Will Jesus zig or zag? Will it be grace or truth? Well, let's keep reading. John tells us Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to cast a stone at her." And once again, he bent down and wrote on the ground. Well, those star-bellied sneetches, those religious leaders, they're about to get their own dose of grace and truth. They're about to learn that they are not so different from the sinners they sought to separate themselves from. Because they were sinners too, those leaders, though they may not have known it. See, we do this thing in religious circles. We divide sin up. We put it into kind of different categories, and we kind of decide which is better or worse than others. And we have these kind of two main categories of sin, it seems. And one's really, really bad. These are the sins of the flesh. Those are the really, really bad ones. And then there's those others, you know, that we call them maybe the sins of the spirit. Now, sins of the flesh, those are the bad ones. You know, and they often involve things of our bodies. Appetites that get out of control, lust, greed, gluttony, drunkenness, laziness. And it was with the case with this woman in this story, these sins of the flesh, they inevitably lead to other sins as well. Deceit, betrayal, despair. So that's the one category we put sin in, but then we create this other category that could be called sins of the spirit, and these have less to do with our biology and more to do with the state of our souls. They have names like pride and arrogance, self-righteousness and judgmentalism. And they're typically not as colorful as the sins of the flesh. They don't provoke as much gossip when you hear about somebody committing one of these. Rarely does a church exercise discipline over one of these sins. If you hear of a pastor, you hear rumors about pastors having to leave a church for a moral reason, you can be pretty sure that reason's not going to be pride. Churches in our day aren't scandalized by sins like arrogance or self-righteousness. We may not be scandalized, but Jesus was. All throughout the Gospels, you can read stories in which a sinner of the flesh and a sinner of the spirit both stand before Jesus. There's the story of the Pharisee and the sinful woman who anointed Jesus' feet. There's the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector, the parable of the prodigal son and his older brother. And yes, this story, these religious leaders versus the woman caught in adultery. And in all of these stories, the people were all guilty. But here's where they were different. The people guilty of the sins of the flesh, they knew it. They knew that they were in big, big trouble, but they also saw Jesus as somebody they could run to in their trouble. And in all of these stories, the people guilty of things like pride and arrogance, well, they were blind. They thought it was possible to love God and despise people. They actually thought that they were paragons of spiritual maturity because they avoided the sins of the flesh, and they had no idea that their sin crippled their ability to love, which is actually what makes the sin of the spirit the most dangerous and destructive of all. We are scandalized by the sins of the flesh. Jesus was most scandalized by these sins of the spirit, because the thing is, here's what's so insidious about sins of the spirit. For the most part, the carriers don't have a clue. At least with the sin of the flesh, you know you've messed up. But with the sin of the spirit, you may never know. You can walk through life with a stone in your hand, just ready to throw. Judgmental thoughts. A superior attitude. Impatient words, bitter resentment, little room for love. You walk around with the stone in your hand, and the people around you, like this woman standing before this crowd, they are trembling in brokenness, in guilt, in fear and lostness. And we are so caught up in our self-righteousness that we don't even see them. Or worse yet, we do see them. And instead of being moved towards compassion, well, we're moved to condemn. These religious leaders needed to know, and we need to remember, that all of us are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared to believe. Yet at the same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared to hope. In Jesus Christ, we all stand in desperate need of grace and truth. With these religious leaders, Jesus holds up that mirror to them and to all of us, and he says, hey, let anyone among you who's without sin, you be the first to cast the stone. And in so doing, Jesus offers them grace and truth to the fullest measure. Truth. You're a sinner. And grace, I love you more than you could ever know. Grace and truth. First, for these religious leaders, and as we finish this story up, most poignantly, Jesus offers grace and truth for this woman as well. The story concludes, when they kept on questioning him, Jesus straightened up and said to them, let anyone who is among you without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." So this crowd, convicted of their own sin, their own need for both grace and truth, they leave. And Jesus looks up and sees only this woman standing there, and he says to her, "Has no one condemned you? Then neither do I." Grace for this woman and for us as well. This incredibly good news for her and for us, that Jesus does not nail us to our past. Jesus does not condemn us. Jesus does not condemn us the way other people condemn us, the way we often condemn ourselves. Jesus forgives us. He wipes the slate absolutely clean. There is no sin so great, so terrible, so shameful that Jesus cannot forgive it. It's grace. You are not condemned. And then the truth. Go your way. And from now on, do not sin. Leave your sin behind. Jesus never condemns. That is for certain. But he also never condones. He loves us far too much to do that. See, Jesus loves us far too much to let us continue in our sin. Not so much because Jesus hates sin itself, though he does. That's not the issue at stake here. What seems to matter to Jesus is not so much the sin that has been done, but what the sin does. Not the sin that has been done, but what the sin does. Jesus hates what sin does, what it does to us, to our hearts, to our relationships, to our world. Jesus hates sin. Jesus refuses to let us continue in our sin because every time we sin, something dies. Sin kills things. Over time, sin will, it'll kill your conscience. We know this. We know that if we continue in a pattern of sin, after a while, things that seemed once so bad and so terrible, they just kind of don't bother you anymore. Sin kills your conscience. It kills your mind, your body, your self-respect, your self-control. Sin kills relationships. You know this. You've experienced this, some of you. Some of you know firsthand how sin can kill your marriage. Sin can kill your family. Sin can kill your relationship with your parents or with your kids. Sin has the power to kill an entire culture. And so Jesus says, go and sin no more. Leave this life that is literally killing you. Grace says, I don't condemn you. And truth says, leave your life of sin. Grace and truth. Jesus always, always, always is filled to the brim with both. I'll close with this. A number of years ago, there was a movie, many of you may have seen it, about Jesus called The Greatest Story Ever Told. And the way they portrayed this particular story, it's pretty good. In this movie, Jesus is confronting the religious leaders and he picks up a stone from the ground and he says, "Who's without sin? Go ahead, cast the first stone." And he circles around to each of them standing there and he holds out that stone as if to say, "Who wants it? Go ahead, take it." And after he goes around and no one takes it, he doesn't just set it down. He throws it down. Because Jesus is literally the only one who can. He's the only one without sin, therefore he's the only person on earth who has the right to cast that stone. And he does. But it's important to notice where. He doesn't throw it at the woman. He doesn't throw it at the religious leaders, and he doesn't throw it away because sin has been committed, because there is a debt, and a debt doesn't just go away. Somebody has to eat it. Somebody has to pay it. And so he casts that stone. He throws it as hard as he can right at his own feet. That's what Jesus is saying here. To the woman, to the religious leaders, and to all of us is this. He says, no, I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you because I will be condemned for you. Yes, stones ought to be thrown, but they will hit me. Spears ought to be launched, but they will pierce my side and not yours. Thorns and nails will be driven in, but I will do the bleeding and not you. So come, friends. Come, sinners. Come, saints. You're forgiven. And you're free. We're really not that different from one another. Sneetches, they had to learn it the hard way. But we don't have to. Jesus came to show us a better way. For the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Jesus is grace and truth for all of us, we who are sinner and saint. We who are both fallen and forgiven. We who are lost and found. We who are holy and completely messed up. We who are holy and completely loved. Jesus is grace and truth for all of us. Thanks be to God. This is a time in our worship where we gather together, all of us, one and the same, to pray for one another, to pray with one another. And I'll invite the pastors and elders to come now to take their place. This is a time for us to be family. Doesn't matter if you have stars or not, but to come with whatever you carry, whoever you are, and bring that before God in prayer together.